Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Hello, Fungula. We're back with another episode. Patrick Warburton is here. You may know him as the voice of Kronk from The Emperor's New Groove. Hilarious Disney movie. Dare I say the most hilarious Disney movie. Yeah, I said it. Very funny. You know his voice from there. You know his voice from Family Guy. You know his voice from all kinds of stuff. And he joins us on this episode. We get into our gratitudes. Our gratitude. He talked about his gratitude of his coaches back when he was in sports and his acting coach, his family. We talk about him growing up Catholic. That's his new stand-up tour and special called Still Catholic. He just started doing stand-up in this past year, and so we get into that. It's a really great episode. And don't forget, go to my website to see when I'm coming to a city near you on my family reunion tour. Go to Angela.com and leave us a message. Call us. Danielle, tell them the voicemail and where they can do all that.
Yeah, so you can give us a call at 747-300-5380 to leave us a voicemail about your gratitudes and gratitudes. Or when you're looking up Angela tickets on her website, there is a form there you can submit. Or if you want to go real old school, just fungulapodcast@gmail.com.
There you go. Send us an email. Tell us your gratitude and your gratitude. We would love to hear from you. Leave us a review, subscribe to my YouTube channel, do all the things so that you can know when this next episode of Fungula comes out. And for now, here it is with Patrick Warburton. Okay, yeah, so people recognizing you as Tom Selleck, that's got to be fun.
Yeah.
I had this thought that I'm sure this has happened to you a bajillion times, that I want to know, like, so what kind of response do you have to this situation? Okay, when you're like at the grocery store or going somewhere ordering something, right, and the register girl's just like bebo bopping and she's like, next, okay, what can I get you, not even looking up, and then as soon as you start talking, the moment of, and they recognize your voice because you have one of the most recognizable voices. I have to imagine that's happened multiple times with you.
Much less than you would imagine.
Really?
Yes.
Because that happens to me.
Yeah.
And I'm just me, but your voice is your voice. Yeah. Really?
Well, I think a lot of times maybe they just don't say anything. There might be a little something in their eyes. And that's
You clock it, right? You see
I
it
can
when they
clock it if they, yes. Uh-huh. But yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that would happen. Yeah. Like,
we go to a lot of the same, you know, grocery stores anyway, so they're kind of used to silly old me anyways, I guess. But every now and then, I remember one time I was in Vegas in a cab with some buddies. They're in the back seat, I'm in the front, and our driver was from some remote country in Africa. And we're just driving along, and I turn back to say something to my buddies, and he goes, "I know who you are. You're Pudi," and he hit me. So taxi drivers from remote areas on the other side of the planet seem to recognize the voice.
Very popular.
You know, Bob at the grocery store sometimes just
keep it moving.
Make eye contact.
Keep it moving.
Keep it moving.
Man. Okay, so you just started stand-up. A year ago.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Tell me, how have you been liking it?
Is a challenge as something that's something that I always wanted to do, but I've always been a little bit of a stand-up snob, you know, and I always thought that in order to be a great stand-up, you have to eat, drink, sleep, and breathe it. In order to be any good and not to be, you know, a mediocre one, I always, you know, wanted to do it. I got my feet wet doing a show, and it was staged readings of Letters from a Nut written by Barry Marder, who's Jerry Seinfeld's producing partner. So he's got like nine of these best-selling books that are compilations of these letters that he's written to where he's punked corporate America. You know, and they're funny. Like he'd punk, you know, Coca-Cola. I have a product, Kayet Doke. He'd write to their legal. I hope it's not a conflict with your Diet Coke. Because they don't taste the same. People say mine tastes like Pepsi. Anyway, I'd like to sell it. Coke Legal would write him back. Absolutely, this is a conflict. You go, I'm so sorry for wasting your time. I've got my 11 cans of soda and my $600 are back in my room right now. I'm so sorry to waste your time. But please try my Proctor Depper, which in no way tastes like Dr. Pepper. I've already cleared it with the Dr. Pepper folks. But so he'll punk them until they're like, all right, we're done with this guy.
Uh-huh.
He's, you know.
That's
but
funny.
But the really funny letters, he wanted me to do staged readings. Did stage readings, but I go, look, if we're going to do them in a comedy club, you got to get comedy club laughs. The corporate responses aren't that funny. So I brought my buddy Mike Wilson, who is one of the best impressionists in the world. A lot of people don't know who Mike is because he's been on cruise ships for 30 years.
Okay.
But he does 1,000 voices, and is really good. So, you know, we made the show, you know, great. And I opened the show with like 10 minutes of talking, which became 10 minutes of stand up, which became 15. I left it at that, but you got to open, walk on stage and, you know, make the introduction.
Did you know that's what you were doing? Like in that moment, you're like, this is my
set. I did realize, like, yes, I want to craft this and make this funnier.
Okay.
The point where it was a lot of fun. And there were folks that were telling me this was their favorite part of the show.
Oh,
and I'm
okay.
Like, I want to do this. And Barry was getting a little whiny about it. he was complaining. And I just go, you know what? I'm done doing that show. I'm just going to do stand-up. Now, I got my feet wet that way. So it was easier than me just like popping on stage with the improv and doing 15 minutes and just, you know, at the age of 60, just sort of, you know, blowing everything up. Why are you doing this?
Are you 60?
Yeah.
That's
and
amazing.
A grandfather now.
Congratulations. How old's your grandbaby?
7 months. His name is Miles Patrick.
Oh, look.
He is a little beauty. Oh, my God.
Did they surprise you with the Patrick name? Like, you see those TikTok videos where they're like, this is my dad's reaction to finding out we named our baby after him.
No, they didn't do that. So Miles is my daughter-in-law's father who passed away years ago. That's his name. And then they took mine in the middle there. So I was honored.
That's precious.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, my son Talon is truly the best daddy I've ever seen. And that's no bias.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
he
cool.
He is so good. I became a better father when they got a little bit older and more, you know, where you could actually communicate with them.
Uh-huh.
But I was sort of overwhelmed. There were, you know, four of them that came along rapidly. And I was good. But I mean, he engages all day long with this guy. He is. Talon is his best friend. Yeah,
that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah.
Where's your daughter in the lineup?
She's second. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So she's 31. She's married to a sheriff.
Oh.
County sheriff. Yeah.
That's fun.
Yes.
You got some stories.
Yes. and then my son Shane is 27, and he's a pilot.
Wow.
Yeah. And
your kids need to get it together.
Yes,
okay.
Right. And then Gabriel's 24, and he's an actor. So Talon and Gabriel are working an awful lot. They're doing a lot of VO. Both of them should be more, I think, spend more time in front of the camera just because they both have such presence. And, you know, it's not just Dad saying that. I mean, you know, Gabriel sings like Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
He has a beautiful singing voice. And he kind of looks a little bit like a cross between James Dean and, I don't know, a young Leo. You know,
we'll take him.
Yes. He should be. Yeah. I offered to send him to New York. I go to New York for 6 months. I go, you should be hitting, you know, because he was, you know, doing the musicals in school and stuff. I'm like, you really need to be doing that. You're so good.
Do you sing too? I should probably know this. But
a little bit. Yes. I would never. I'm not going to quit my day job. But a little bit. Yeah. Yeah.
Like Frank Sinatra type singing?
No. Like, I used to have a Pearl Jam cover band. We were the Bearded Pearl Clams. It was our bass guitar player that came with that. Sorry about that, Angela. What's the bass guitar player going to come? You know, and jazz musicians in the band, they have horrible. So that was us. Yeah. I'm not really doing that now.
Because you're stand-up.
Every now and then. Yeah, I've sort of, you know, focused on that this last year.
So, okay, you have your tour, your Still Catholic tour,
yeah,
which I love that name.
Yeah.
Hilarious. tell me about that name, first of all.
Well, because there's a lot of, I never thought that it, you know, even give a name, but then when I went on tour and I was, you know, traveling, I thought, boy, if it had a name, it would be Still Catholic. All right, we'll go with that, because there's a lot that has to do with, you know, mom and dad and growing up and, you know, and all that, you know, overwhelming religiosity, you know, I had parents that hated, you know, Family Guy. My mother's literally cried on the phone for me to leave. My mother, it's part of the act two where she's actually presented me with a petition to sign to get Family Guy off the air, because she works with the Parents Television Council, and that's their biggest fish to fry, is to get Family Guy off the air.
My gosh. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Did you sign it?
You know, Seth wanted to interview her one time, and I go, oh, as much as I love to get mom back, I can't throw her under the bus, because she would be in way over her head in an interview with Seth.
Absolutely not.
As funny as that would be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wow. Yeah. That's so interesting. Yeah. Okay, so Still Catholic. Are you guys really still Catholic? Are you active Catholic? Like,
we're not really active. Uh-huh. Yes. But if someone were to say, what are you?
You're like Easter Catholic?
Yeah. Barely that. I mean, I can't get the family to go to, you know, church on even the holidays. They're like, you're pressuring us. Mm-hmm. I'm like, all right.
But on the form, when you got to fill one out, you're
that's where
we'll
it
check
is.
Check this one.
But, you know, you ask what, like, I mean, in regards to all this, you know, I've never known this kind of autonomy before. I've always been told what to do, what to say, where to say it, when to say it, how to say it, you know, and all of a sudden you write on your material, you do it how you want, when you want, where you want. And then again, there's a little bit of a risk, you know, I'm a little naughty, you know, and Kathy's like, sometimes she's like, you have to, you know, think about your brand to protect. I'm like, hon, I know, but comedy stand-up is a whole different thing. Yeah. And there's got to be a freedom in that form to be able to be a little dangerous too, you know?
Yeah.
And,
so always, your mom has not seen your show.
She's not. She may at some point, yes. But, oh boy, yeah.
Oh my goodness. I mean, yeah, this is it's your act, it's your life, it's your material. You get to portray what you want of your life and how you want it. And, you know, like, I'm an exaggerated version of myself on stage, you know, with my stories that I tell about my life. And I know when to dig deeper into this version of myself. When I'm telling a story where I want to seem more uneducated than I actually am, I will lean into that side of me because I have an uneducated side of me, but I also have an educated side of me. Right. But when I'm telling this particular story, I'm going to lean in real hard to, like, I don't even know that book. I never even heard of that book. I'm going to lean into it to sell the point of this story.
We play roles on stage. That's what, you know, you have to do. You know, 1,000 years ago, you know, I mean, the court jesters had an immunity that nobody else had, because if they didn't have that freedom to be dangerous and say something that would potentially get their head cut off, they wouldn't say things. They wouldn't be able to have the freedom to, you know, to be funny. And so you play roles on stage, you know. I remember, you know, well, I had done a show, you know, this is, you know, you know, I don't know, 6 months ago, 7 months ago. And it was in a joint that wasn't even really, you know, a comedy club. I don't know how I ended up getting booked there. I got, you know, I ended up doing shows at, like, Helium in Atlanta. But then I went off to do something in Athens, and which is really cool, because Mike Mills is a buddy of mine. He comes and plays in my St. Jude event every year. And I've known Mills from REM for years, you know. So he came to the show. It was like in a school kind of auditorium where, like, front row is like 50 feet back there. And it's just dark. I mean, it's not that kind of environment. It wasn't really a great show. You know, and somebody online goes, yeah, I was there. I didn't, you know, think it was funny. There was an anti-trans joke and a racist joke. And there is not.
Uh-huh.
But when you're on stage, sometimes you deal with things that might have to do with trans or have to do with race. I mean, I do this, you know, stupid joke where, you know, I talk about, you know, where I'd been nominated for an Annie, you know, years ago for The Emperor's New Groove. And everybody's like, hey, we love Croc. And then I go, unfortunately for me, I was nominated against the great Eddie Murphy for Mulan, who I go, obviously won, black. And then just
move on. And they were not happy.
I'm playing a role. The guy who's like, well, I would have gotten the job if I was ethnic. Do you know what I'm saying? Everybody laughs at it. My black brothers and sisters laugh harder than anybody at it. You know what I'm saying? You're playing a role. You could take these things out of context and go, 100. He thought he didn't get that role. You know, it's like people have to have that sensibility. My wife is very, very literal. you know, very smart, but very literal. So it's really funny. Whenever I pitch something to her, she's like, that's just stupid. Or I don't get, or she goes, I don't get it. That's just stupid. And then I'll write a check next time. I go, this is going to work. And it almost always does. You know, okay. You are not, you, the wife is not the audience. You know, if she laughs at something, I'm always wary. I'm like, this might not be that good.
Let me rework this.
Yes.
Wait, why are you laughing?
Because there has to be that element of absurdity, you know, in things and stuff. But yeah, I love how people react. Back, you know, shortly after the George Floyd tragedy, we had something called Blackout Tuesday on Instagram. Do you remember that? Where we just posted black people. So I do that, and somebody on my Instagram goes, way to go, Patty, you just ended racism.
Oh, yeah, I remember seeing a lot of those comments.
I've left it there, right? I didn't do anything. You know, and I go, there's a part of me that wanted to weigh in and go, just to show solidarity. That's it is. Sorry that I didn't meet your approval. And then I'm like, there are other things I hope are more of an effort, like, you know, going to the Congo on hearing aid missions with my friend Dikembe Mutombo, who passed away, but a wonderful man, or starting an event for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital 15 years ago, which is based upon the foundation of helping every child of every race and color and eradicating catastrophic disease, you know, and by year three, it was the number one event in the nation for St. Jude. Yeah, we have satellite events.
That's cool.
And then I go, but that would just be me bragging on the internet. And I'm not going to do that. But, you know, people are so quick to judge on everything, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Do you, as you're a year into writing material and practicing being a more dangerous version of yourself than what your brand was before, right? Like being more honest, or letting this be your playground of, like, you know, trying new things. Have you found any hesitancy? Like, are you, do you find yourself getting scared to, like, oh, I don't know if I should say it? Or are you just like, freedom?
Well, yeah. There's a little bit of that, but you have to, you know, tread. I love to tread into waters where people get nervous and they're like, is he going to hang himself right here? But I feel like you have to do that. I've never been that. There are those that are pretty squeaky clean and hilariously funny. And, of course, Nate Bargatze is one of those.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, been my voice or where what I lean into. I wish I could just, you know, do that. That doesn't seem to be my territory.
Yeah.
But it's just been a remarkable and a really fun, you know, experience. I just got back from a month in the Northeast, where I flew into Rochester, got a rental car, and put about 2,500 miles on in 27 days. And it was just from city to city, and, you know, some of them, you're doing five shows in 3 days. My first day out, you know, in Buffalo, they'd sold out 7 and 9:30 shows. So they put on a 4:30 show.
Wow.
And I go 75 minutes. So I go, wow, I did 4 hours on stage my first day out. And so a lot of it was a great run. So many of the shows are great. You know, the very last thing I did when I was in New York, and I was, you know, this is after, you know, hitting, you know, Buffalo and Connecticut and Baltimore and DC, and I went to Philly and Pittsburgh, Virginia Beach, Richmond. I was just, you know, at that point, you know, like, exhausted. I got one last show, which is at Rodney's in Manhattan. And so the guy has booked me and all that stuff. He goes, don't be shocked. He goes, because when you go, he goes, you're used to, you know, doing five, you know, big shows. He goes, it's Sunday evening in Rodney's. There's going to be 80 people, which there was. You know, no big deal. Had a, you know, fun little show. I'm laying on the couch in the green room. I'm exhausted at this point. I can't wait. I'm going home early the next day. I'm laying on the couch, and the two bathrooms are downstairs, you know. So I could hear a couple of ladies go into the bathroom talking. They don't have no idea I'm like 10 feet away.
Sure.
And the one guy goes, that was fun, wasn't it? And the other guy goes, I was falling asleep. I'm laying on the couch, and I was this close to saying it's not for everybody, but I was literally too exhausted, so I just laid there giggling. I just thought that was funny.
So you're a year in, you've already recorded a special. It sounds like you're having success on the road. Like, that's not normal, even for somebody who has a name like yourself. You already have celebrity, you already, like, people know who you are. It's still really hard to sell a ticket, and it sounds like you're doing great within your first year. What has been, like, the most, I guess you wouldn't even know that that's surprising, like, if it happened right out the gate that people were buying tickets to your show, then it's probably, it takes a while to to feel the, oh, this is actually hard to do, which is a little similar to my journey. My YouTube video blew up, and I immediately started selling tickets like right away. So I didn't get that hustle grind, how hard it is to sell a ticket right away. Like it took a while. Like I was very spoiled right out the gate.
Yeah.
And so it took a while for me to be like, wait a minute, this is hard to do, when I would find out my markets that had no idea who I was. Yeah. Like I would be so spoiled out here in Texas, selling out shows over here in California. And then I'd head over to like Pittsburgh and it was like 19 tickets sold. And I was like, wait, what? Hold on. Yeah. And realize like all the press that I had to do to try to sell tickets. And I'm like, oh my gosh, wait a minute. This is hard. Like I didn't know that right away. So you're a year in and it sounds like you're having success. You have your tour, you have your special already. Yeah. Like, has that been surprising for you to see like how many people are actually really wanting to come out and see you?
Yeah, it's been great. You know, and the shows have been going good. I've had other comics go, well, sure, you know, you got a name, so you can, you know, it buys you maybe the first 4 or 5 seconds on stage.
Exactly.
That's it.
That's right.
And people come out and they're going to see Stamp Show. That's what they want to see, you know. Although a lot of my stuff is anecdotal. It's not filled with, you know, industry anecdotes, because that is relatable. There are just a handful of them that I find are, and I could lean into them and build stand up throughout them, but they can't just be stories. So much of what I do is very relatable in regards to that. I've been married for 34 years. I have 4 kids, you know, I've had 7 dogs. I have a relatively relatable life, you know, and I like to, you know, focus more on that and being a parent and all that. But there are some, you know, insane stories that I have within there that seem to play well. But I've had, you know, comics who've been, you know, buddies that have been doing this for 30 years, you know, and they'll pitch me something and I go, well, I can't do that because it didn't actually happen. Mm-hmm. And then they'll go, everybody thinks that when they're at a show that everything a comic says on stage is BS. And I go, that is not true. I can tell. I can tell when something just seems to be a very, there's the comedic construct and they're going to present it as if it actually happened. And I can tell that it's made up or if it's not. Uh-huh. And that's why I love the anecdotal comics like, you know, Chappelle or Patton. It's great, you know. And then again, I love just the damn funny ones like, you know, Louis C.K., who makes everything up, but it's just so damn funny, you know. You know, or Bill or whatnot. Bill Burr does a lot of, you know, he does anecdotal stuff too. You know, he's got a great, you know, the way he mixes it all up. But I do try to keep it authentic. Mm-hmm. There are the jokes in there. And those jokes are pretty obvious that this is, you know, this is a construct and just perspective, as opposed to this is perspective on something that actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's so cool, man. Yeah. Okay. So this podcast is centered in gratitude.
Yes.
You know, we talk about things that we're grateful for, but we also talk about things that we're mad about. Yeah. What is our mattitude? And that's like, what's getting on your nerves lately? It could be something silly. It could be something that has been your pet peeve for your whole life, but what makes you mad? Like, what's something that just
I don't know how mad it makes me, but it is frustrating when somebody can just take one thing and blow it out of proportion or this or that, like we just talked about earlier in regards to the, you know, their perspective on something that you did or said. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's just very, it's so very, very, very narrow minded. You know, everybody has a voice. Everybody can go on absolutely anything these days, whether it be Reddit or social media or whatnot, and say whatever they want, faceless, say whatever they want. And someone's going to read that and, you know, assume that's the truth, you know, like, oh, that must be the case. And it's just not.
And I think on our end, at least for me, I'll just speak for myself. I feel like when I see those comments, that one person represents more people.
Right.
That what they're saying, their negative, false perspective.
Right.
Represents more than just them. I'm like, that's how people think? What people? No, this dude.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, we give that one comment too much power, I think.
Right.
Too much.
We do, because when you're on stage and you see how, you know, 400 people are responding to something, you realize that people don't feel that way.
Right. I have a thing where, like, I find a lot of people do, but I'll just, again, just speak for myself. I can read 1,000 beautiful comments that are just so positive and affirming.
I see where
and
this
then
is going.
You see that one negative yes. one, right?
Yeah.
And this used to affect me more, but if that negative comment is specific enough, it like weasels its way into my brain.
Uh-huh.
Like if it's specific enough about either a joke that I wrote or a way that I look or something, if it's specific enough, it like gets lodged, right? So there is one example is I read a comment, this was years ago. This is in my second hour special. And it was about a joke I did about my husband trying to use my toothbrush. Like when we first got married, he wanted to borrow my toothbrush. And I'm like, this guy got to be out of his mind. Like, how did you grow up? Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is wild. So I did a whole joke about him trying to borrow my toothbrush. And then somebody left a comment saying something about how cheesy this joke is. Like, really sharing a toothbrush? Like, this is the cheesiest blah, 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 whatever. But in the show, it gets a huge laugh. It gets a huge response. Like, it's relatable. You see, and then like you see people who are like, yeah, I don't have a problem with it. Like, are you kidding me? That's crazy. And it actually like ignites opinions. It incites opinions in people. And this is actually a really good story and a really good bit. But this one comment, for months after I read that comment, every time I was about to say this joke, I saw the comment in my brain right before I said it. Every single time for months. And I'm like, oh my God, I hate this. I hate that I see that comment every time I do this joke. And then I do the joke. Hilarious. People love it. It's a whole moment that I'm having with the audience. But this one person had something specific to say and it lodged in my brain for a long time.
Sure. Well, look, and you know, I mean, in regards to everything, almost, you know, everything that we can all, you know, relate to in regards to society and whatnot, it's all been spoken about or talked about in one way or another. Mm-hmm. It's about unique perspective on things. Yes, perhaps, you know, there are those who have, you know, discussed the sharing the toothbrush thing, but there's different ways to discuss that. Your experience is different than anybody else's.
Right.
And if there's a funnier perspective you can put on it, then, you know, you do, but it's not like, you know, things aren't quite always, you know, as original as that. There's mm-hmm. always, in one way or another, every construct and issue has literally been talked about in one way or another, especially on the, you know, the stage and comedy clubs. But it's all about, you know, making these things personal and original and different and relatable that way.
From your point of view, from your perspective.
Yeah.
I think it's supposed to be topics that everybody has already talked about because that's what makes us human, the things that connect us on a human level, which is relationship, number one.
Yeah.
Everyone has a relationship, whether it's your wife, your husband, your mother, your father, your siblings, your coworker, your boss, your friend. It's a working relationship. It's a friendship relationship. It's a marriage relationship. Yeah. Everyone has relationship.
Yeah.
So the topic itself is something that everybody taps into, but you tapped into it with your own perspective, with your own trauma, with your own background, with your own, the way you grew up, with your own injuries, with your own heartbreak, with your own, like all the things that made you, your unhealed parts of you that you're adding to this relationship story that this person who also did a relationship story didn't have what you have. And so you have your own spin and take on it and perspective. And that's why people appreciate you and they see what you're doing. And that's why you can continue to have a successful career because you continue to honor yourself, even though it's a topic that's been talked about. It's from you, who you are as a person.
I throw my wife heavily under the bus in the show. And she has no issues with it. I mean, we've been married for 34 years. We were together 8 years before then. We've been together forever. Nobody wants to hear anybody go on stage and go, my wife's wonderful. Yay, yay, mm-hmm. yay. Understand that, you know, the perspective and you know, and what the stories you're telling on stage in regards to the annoyances and this and what you've got to deal with. you know, is all part of it. And is there an element of truth to it? Absolutely, uh-huh. there is. Sure. Do you know what I'm saying? At the same time, it's not, you know, and then I've had people, you know, and women after shows going, I love your wife. And I'm like, that's your takeaway? Uh-huh. listen, I do too. You know, and...
does your wife like your set?
Seemingly.
Does she ever pitch you ideas like, why don't you talk about the time we did this?
yeah, sure, I'll get that every now and then, yeah. Or from buddies. Why don't you talk about the time we did this? And I go, yeah, it's different, you know.
Yeah.
Because we used to do so much stupid stuff in the past. But sure. I don't want to get on stage and go, this is what my buddies and I used to do. And how uh-huh. stupid was this? And uh-huh. so I go, that doesn't really translate to
no.
comedy. What translates, everybody can say, oh, you know, this is what we used to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find that there needs to be, you need to take people, you know, wormholes and different stuff and hit them at different angles mm-hmm. with stuff. And sometimes it's a horrible perspective on something that's yeah. normally just rather benign, you know, and you throw curveballs. That's what you got to do.
So people taking things out of context or blowing things out of proportion is
a little aggravating. Sure.
Aggravating. Yeah. That's what you're mad at. We call it a mattitude.
Yeah.
That's your mattitude. Look. We'll call it agritude for you. Yeah. We'll call it your agritude. okay, let's move into gratitude. Let's talk about some things that you're grateful for in your life. And whether it's like from today, something that happened this morning that you're like, oh, I'm so grateful for that. That was really cool. Or like something from third grade that you're like, you remember this teacher who said this and changed your life. You know, whatever.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about, I went through a period years ago. This is like 25 years ago. I'm old. You know, some of the men that I was grateful for in my life, other than my father, that helped me. One of them was my crew coach, you know, when I rode crew in college. And the other was an acting coach that I had. It was also a fantastic writer and director named David Baird. And I just called him up one time and just wanted to, you know, grab lunch with them. Mm. And when we were sitting there, he kind of wanted to know what this is all about. And I go, I just, because I'm grateful that you were, you know, my acting coach. I go, I don't, you know, Luke Perry was in my class. Luke and I were close friends up until he passed. Mm. And we both discussed that if it wasn't for David Baird, neither of us felt like we would ever have worked. Because he was such a supportive, you know, so many acting coaches get on a pedestal and this and that. He was just very supportive. And so... he made everybody feel confident. And if you feel confident, then you can work and you can take chances. And he was good in all those areas. He was, he found it quite remarkable that's why I wanted to sit with him, was to thank him, you know, because he was a writer and a director. He always felt like somebody wanted something from him. And I go, I don't want anything from you, David. I just want to say thank you.
Wow.
And then he goes, I'm going to write a movie for you. And I go, well, thank you, David. That'd be great. A week later, he wrote Fast. Literally a week later, he's got a script. He goes, I'm going to send it to you. And so I read it, and I go, all right, let's do it. And it was a real gritty, gritty little film. Shot on PAL, so it doesn't look great. Called The Civilization of Maxwell Bright. And we did it, and it was a really cool project. I mean, I won Best Actor in New York and Tribeca at the Boulder Film Festival and the Beverly Hills Film Festival.
Wow. Congrats.
Very few people ever saw this film because it's really gritty. Also, the whole, you know, first 20 minutes, he's such a misogynist and he's so ugly that, you know, there were those that were just, I can't endure this for 2 hours.
Yeah.
But there's a tremendous sort of... you know, journey that this man goes through, and he's led through by this remarkable spiritual woman, and then finds some grace towards the end. But it was weird. So that just came from just being grateful, wanting to thank this guy.
Yeah.
And then we do it. Yeah.
Did you find it interesting when you were like, "Thank you so much for who you are," and he's like, "I'm gonna write a movie," and then you start reading the movie and you read all the misogyny on it, you're like, wait, what did you get out of our lunch? Hold on.
Well, wait, I knew what he wanted to do, because he told me, he goes, you do a lot of comedy and this and that and everything, and he goes, but I know, you know, what your chops are, I know what your potential is, and I'd love to throw you into the realm of
love
having
that.
To
he
do
did
something
that for you.
Dangerous like that. So wow. Yeah, I'll always be grateful to him for that.
And then you won those awards.
Yeah, it was cool, which means nothing. But, you know, it's nice that people appreciate something. Yeah.
I think you're right. It's like in the end of the day, you don't have to win an award for validation and knowing something that you did was good and outstanding. But for somebody like yourself who, like your acting coach was saying, your comedy chops, like you're in this comedy world, to be into, be in a world that's you're not known for and then be recognized for it by others. I feel like that's gotta feel good. Like that's gotta feel
it,
like
it does. I'm very grateful for Barry Sonnenfeld, who is an amazing filmmaker and, you know, started off being one of the great DPs and then becoming an amazing filmmaker that, ever since we worked together on The Tick, he always wanted to integrate me in projects he did. You know, when we did a series of unfortunate events, I wouldn't have been on Netflix's top 200 list. They just don't look at me, you know, in that realm. But fortunately, Daniel Handler, who wrote the books, and Barry Sonnenfeld both agreed that I should play Lemony Snicket. You know, if it wasn't for an amazing filmmaker like Barry Sonnenfeld, I, you know, should think that what so much of my career would have just been if I wasn't involved with him. So those people in the business that, I've been grateful for, because I'm not really crazy about the way everything works, the way they box you up or the way they put everybody in and they just think you just do one thing. I've always found it interesting when you see somebody who you think just does one thing and does something else. Mm-hmm. Sling Blade's one of my favorite little films of all time. People were just found it so remarkable that, you know, John Ritter, you know, wasn't tripping over couches in that. Well, that's what he did in Three's Company. He's an actor.
Yeah. Well.
Right? You know? So I always think it's interesting when you see somebody who you think just does one thing, make a turn and do something else.
Oh, yeah.
But that's, you know, outside of that, you know what I'm really grateful for is that my family is in good health and we have a healthy grandbaby. I'm thankful for all those things. I'm thankful that my four kids are just also such wonderful people involved in a great family. Same thing that what I'm not grateful for is all the worry. And people don't understand this. You know, I have bachelor buddies that are my age. You know, they're 60 years old. And I do see that they don't have a care in the world. And they literally don't. They don't worry every day about the health and well-being of their four kids and everybody. They don't know. That's stressful, you know? And it doesn't matter how old they get, you will worry about your children every day of your life.
So it doesn't get better.
No, I have a 2-year-old. Sorry to tell you that.
I can't even breathe sometimes.
Yeah.
My intrusive thoughts are just through the roof. And I only have one. I can't even imagine. Four?
Yeah.
I would just be a shell of myself, like just worried all day long. That's wild. Yeah. Did you always want a big family?
Well, I guess I always figured, you know, that something like that would happen. I came from it was me and my three sisters. And it was, you know, mostly a joy growing up. And we were all very close. Yeah. My three sisters, we're all within like 4 or 5 years. So we were all, you know, very close growing up. And I see, you know, what it ultimately it's been for all of them, because they're all best friends, which is great when they have issues.
Yeah.
They're involved enough that they deal with them.
Yeah. You know? That's me and my siblings. Yeah. We're all very close. And I just had my brother on the podcast. I brought him on and I had my sister on the podcast, and we're very, very close. And I think about that, like with my daughter, she's an only child and I feel sad sometimes, like, oh, she's not going to have what I had. And I feel sad about that. But I am very close with my siblings. But I wanted to ask, you mentioned something about your bachelor friends that don't have a care in the world. I have a bachelor dad who I feel like also does not have a care in the world. Only he has four kids. No, five. He have four that are full sibling, me and my sister and my brothers. And then we have a half brother. So my dad has five kids, but he's still like bachelor dude. Like, as long as he has a roof over his head and he has his burrito that he could eat and then he just rides his Harley, he's good.
Does he get high?
No, he used to back in the day, but then.
Because I think that might help with that.
Yeah. No. Then he found the Lord and then all the things, but he just rides his Harley. He's retired. He just goes and lives his life. And then, I know I talked to him, I don't know, we used to talk a lot more, but I rarely, I'll hear from one of my siblings like, oh, dad's in Idaho or something. And then I think I ran. I called him the other day, and I was just like, "Hey, Dad, where are you up to?" He's like, "Oh, we're in Sturgis right now." And, you know, we rode, and then my dad is the king of details. He gives you all the details that you don't need. He's like, yeah, we rode, and then Renee, they trailered their bike because they're not actually going to ride it till they get to Sturgis. So they trailered their bike, and it was like 15 minutes of details, you know, of just random stuff. And then I'll probably hear from him again in maybe like 3 months.
Right. Well, you know, it might not be... it might be a strength in a way and not an uncaring. Do you know what I'm saying? I think there are those of us that are just more, you know, worrying, being worrisome is just more of our nature and our neuroses and our, you know, as opposed to being able to compartmentalize and just not going through life that way, you know. And I wish that I had that strength at times to just not... you know, deal with my insomnia and my worry in regards to
is your wife family. Similar to you?
No.
No? Not that she
just can sleep. I think I just jumped right on the insomnia thing. It's like, how the hell did you just fall asleep within 2 minutes? You know, I mean, I'll take a sleeping pill and 2 hours later after, you know, a bowl of ice cream in bed, you know, I might doze off for 4 hours. I'm really envious of that. Yeah, I feel like it's going to kill me someday. Like, you can't exist on 4 hours of sleep every night, but don't sleep well.
I don't know. I think Kevin Hart does. I read that somewhere. Like, I think he sleeps like 4 hours or something. I don't know if that's true or not, but it was like...
he's smaller, so I feel like maybe he needs less sleep.
He only needs half the sleep.
Yeah. That's what I take away from that.
Oh, that's funny. Give me another gratitude. What else are you grateful for in your life? Wait, you talked about your crew. What's crew?
Crew. It's the 8-man boats where you row.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. So like rowing?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, okay, okay.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is I did it for 1 year. But it was the most remarkable year in many different ways in regards to team bonding, you know, brotherhood. So like me and the guys that, you know, we rode in the boat and a lot of the other guys from the team are still in a group chat.
No way.
Sometimes we see each other at, you know, the alumni regattas and we play golf together. And a lot of them have actually come to my shows, which has been really, really cool for me.
That's cool, man.
But, you know, I just, you know, love and appreciate all those guys so much. And crew is one of those sports where it's not individual. It is, when you talk about a team sport, you know, the boat moves best when it's in swing, as they say. It's just, it's like everybody is so, you know, in key and tune in that boat. It's hard to, you know, really, you know, put a finger on what it is that when you're in such synchronicity. Mm-hmm. So it's that ultimate like team sport, you know, and I had a horrible experience in it too. And the alumni regatta, not the alumni regatta, the Newport regatta, which is the one that we host in Newport Beach that we should have won, but I caught a crab. And catching a crab is when you get your oar stuck. You don't get out.
No.
It just puts the brakes on the boat.
Oh,
you know?
My gosh.
So, you know, in a race with, I don't know, 5 or 6 boats, you know, including UCLA, who we'd already beat that year, you know, we're in the lead, and I got caught in, and, you know, and you feel like, you know, you drop the touchdown pass of the homecoming game, you know. But the guys, you know, they didn't get on me. It's just part of, you know, it's part of it. And these things happen.
Why'd you only do it 1 year?
Because I pretty much failed out of junior college the next year. Yeah. I just decided I just kind of stopped going to class. I guess I had a attention deficit disorder, which I never knew until this last year when my daughter diagnosed me with it. She did. She just calls me up and she goes, "Dad, I have ADHD. I got it from you." That was it. Yeah. And so, I'm like, oh my God, that makes sense. I also hadn't discovered coffee back then. So I didn't, you know, if I had grabbed a Venti latte and walked into my, you know, auditorium class after rowing crew, I would have maybe stayed awake and been more attentive. But after you row boats for 2 hours in the morning and then you go to class and you're not on caffeine, I would doze off. And so I just left. That was it. I sort of failed out. And this is the funny thing, and which I even address in the show, is how I, 2 years ago, they made me alumni of the year and the commencement speaker at the college that I sort of just failed out of.
No way. One of our biggest success stories for his whole year at our school.
Amazing.
No way.
Yeah.
Love that.
What, so did you go into the industry right after that?
Yeah.
What made you, so, okay, taking it back, growing up, did you always want to do entertainment industry? Were you always like, I'm going to be an actor, I'm going to...
I felt like that. Anyways, my mother was an actress, and not professionally while she was raising a family. My dad got her out of the biz. He was a surgeon. She would have been very successful. She was doing all the shows back then. You know, Gunsmoke. She actually died in Matt Dillon's arms. She did Alfred Hitchcock wow. Presents and One Step Beyond and wow. Dobie Gillis and all, you know, all the big TV shows back then. She was with MCA. She had the same agents as like Dean and Brando. Wow. And when she's 22 years old, they had a whole year's worth of work lined up in California. This is when she's like 23 years old. And my dad was like, nope, you're not going to California. You're going to stay here, be my wife, and have my children. And aww. That was it. This is, you know, back when, you know, she always says no regrets. Yeah, she could have had a great career. But I would watch her do community theater, you know, because that's what would sate her, you know, in our community in Huntington Beach there. And it was fun for her to do. And for me, it was just fun to, like, be backstage, watch the evolution of a show. Mm-hmm. I love Jerry Lewis movies. And also, you know, I mean, I was in those early years, really struggled, you know, for like, you know, attention, not really in my home. I felt like we were really cared for, but I was the smallest kid freshman year in high school. I weighed 95 pounds.
Whoa.
Coke
whoa.
Bottle glasses. Cause I am
cutie.
Blind. Oh, blind. Oh, such a geek. Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, these were like goggles.
Oh
yeah. I'm still to this day not a candidate for laser surgery because I have too pronounced of astigmatism, but I'm cross-eyed, far-side. I need like 850 power and
they're like,
eyes.
Bro, this ain't going to help you.
Yeah.
Don't even. Yeah, don't waste your time.
Yep. We can't do that for you.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I feel like there's a part, you know, of all actors that, you know, maybe kind of struggle for, you know, maybe acceptance or, you know.
So this whole time you've been acting, people think you're doing like a sexy smoky eye, but you're just trying to see.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, it's a natural part. Yeah, it's just I'm a squinter. Yes. I love that squinting thing you do. Oh, trying to see.
Can you give us more of that smoky sexy? Oh, that's good. Oh, my gosh. Okay, did your mom show you her old work? Was she ever like, okay, sit down, everybody. We're going
to
watch my
she loved to talk Alfred about it, Hitchcock. Yeah, and we'd see. Okay. Yeah, but it was fun. Wow. Yeah, we always really wanted to. Look, it was always fun to see her back in those days doing stuff. Yeah.
Were your parents supportive of you wanting to be in the entertainment industry?
They were. They just weren't really happy about almost anything I was doing. I mean, if it wasn't, you know, Highway to Heaven, you know, or Little House on the Prairie, they weren't thrilled. One of the first jobs I ever got, or no, it was first. It was in the early days. So the first episode I ever got, actually, because okay. I've been doing a number of sitcoms up to that point. But when my first episode of Seinfeld, I got a letter from a politician in Orange County. I'm trying. Yeah. I don't know who it was. And he goes, you don't know who I am, but I know your parents, and I can only imagine how disappointed
no!
they are in your choices. Yes. And he was right, because the only other piece of what I would refer to as hate mail I got was a 6-page letter from my father. Disappointed he was.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. How did that affect you? Like, I'm talking about a random stranger leaving me a comment that I'm like, man, I thought about it for 3 months. Like...
Right. Well, because I always knew what their person. My father was in the monastery for 3 months before we went into medicine. And as I like to say, my mother is worse. you know, and so, yeah, that very first episode of Seinfeld I did was I just played Jerry's mechanic and I steal his move and I'm using it on Elaine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're just, you know, it was just a little too sexy. It didn't deal with the, you know, the human sex act with any sanctity, which is. Please.
Oh.
Yeah, gotcha. That's how. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Gotcha. Over the top they are. Yeah.
Did you address? Like, was this a 6-page letter where you had to like address your father and be like, "Okay, but I'm still acting. Like, I see what you're saying. Thank you for your opinion."
It probably just came out at that point more in a conversation of frustration, you know. But I didn't communicate with him a lot on this because he was from a different world and he wasn't going to see the way I saw things there. He left a message on my phone one time and this was it. Patrick, because he would get his information from my mom with the Parents Television Council. So they would know what was going to be in a in a future episode of Family Guy before it was even on the air.
Okay.
Patrick, in a future episode of Family Guy, God is sitting in a lazy boy chair next to a bottle of lotion getting ready to masturbate. I wish you would get off that show. Click. And, hang up. And you know, the conversation I couldn't have with my father is, well, Dad, God is not a guy like you with a beard sitting in a lazy boy chair next to a bottle of lotion. It's called satire.
Mm-hmm.
It's satire. They don't understand that. It's all blasphemy to them, you know, and it's impossible for me to explain that to them if they don't get satire, you know. And so I understood what I was up against, and I understood that it will never change, and that you just have to follow your path and do what you do. But they, I mean, they would rather see me, you know, shooting up a place with a gun in a movie than, you know, anything sexual.
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. Just not really.
So interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. People draw their own lines and then
expect you to follow them.
Expect everyone to follow them.
Sorry it didn't work out, Mom and Dad. Oh, they sent me to those Catholic schools.
Oh, man. Okay. What, so you started in the industry, you started getting yours. Okay. How many episodes of Seinfeld did you do?
Only 9 regular season, 10 including the final.
When you first were cast in that role, was it just one and people loved you and they kept bringing you back? Like, how did that work?
Yeah. Well, I know that, you know, Jerry and Larry David loved the characters. So they brought him back. What was frustrating is I could have done the whole last, you know, could have done season 6 through season 9, but I had already signed on to another show and it was a different network. So during season 7 and 8, when they were calling about availability, I couldn't do it because I was on a Friday night sitcom that nobody watched.
Oh, no. Yeah. That's my dream world. Sitcom life. Oh.
Yeah. Oh, my God. You'd be awesome. So, well, there's just not really as many anymore, is there, because of streaming and all that. Yeah.
I know, but that's my dream world. Oh, my God. You got to live that sitcom life of just table read to rehearsal to pre-shoot to live tape and done for the weekend.
Oh, I don't know. I see you as young, funny sitcom mom. I do. Yes.
Thank you. Can you tell everyone you know, please?
Hear it now from that David Putty fellow. Angela. That's the show, Angela. And I love the spelling.
Thank you so much.
That's all it is right there. Angela. That's all it is. Angela's world.
Yeah, I'll take it. Any one of them, I'll take.
Is a bongo in it, or what's his name?
Bonzo.
Bonzo, that's
Bonzo, like garbanzo bean. Oh, my gosh, yes, he's the mascot. What, okay, in your career, you've had, you know, so many cool things, which, fun fact, on a recent episode, we were talking about Emperor's New Groove, without actually talking about Emperor's New Groove, because I couldn't remember the name of it, but we were talking about our favorite Disney movies, and Danielle over here said Hercules, which I find weird. And so we were talking about Little Mermaid and, you know, Aladdin. And I was like, but there's this one movie that was so funny and it was like a donkey or like a horse or, and I kept trying to describe it and it could not come to my brain. And then if you go to the YouTube, the comments are like, Emperor's New Groove. You're talking about Emperor's New Groove.
It's a llama.
It was so funny. Yeah. They're like, it's a llama. But so you've had like such great, oh, this is before I get to this question, because I'm going to lose this thought again. Was voice acting something that you knew you wanted to do, like acting, or was this like a surprise to you? Like actually your voice. And then you just started getting,
that was a surprise to me because I was always, you know, it was all about live action, you know, and, I had never really considered it, but my wife, encouraged it. And then we had neighbors when we lived in Woodland Hills and a super fun couple, Drew and Scott. Drew is an agent at Sutton Bartham and Ari. Scott is a voiceover actor. And so I met them and they had me come over. They go, if you have any interest at all. So I went over and I met them over there and I've been with them since the very beginning. And that's when I had, right off the bat, had some fantastic opportunities. Tim Allen wasn't going to do the voice of Buzz Lightyear in the TV series. And so I got offered that. So I auditioned cool. for it, and I got that. And I knew exactly right off the bat that I was going to be the poor man's Buzz. You know, I remember as a kid growing up, you'd see the Saturday morning cartoons like, wait a minute, that's not the real guy. Yeah, I go, I'll take it.
Yeah.
And then I did The Emperor's New Groove right around then. And that's when Family Guy came along right at that same time, you know. And since then, it's been, you know, Disney movies and, you know, some cool Adult Swim shows like The Venture Brothers. Mm-hmm. That's been a really fun one. Mm-hmm. You know, Scooby-Doo and all that's Kim Possible. I love working with Disney. I've worked with Disney a lot. And I love being a part of Disney stuff just because I have very vivid, special memories from like the time I was 5 years old, you know, going to Disneyland. Mm-hmm. And I feel is the way, you know, millions of people across this planet feel that Disney has always been, there's just Disney and there's nothing else that compares, you know, in regards to, you know, you know, a theme park in a movie studio. No, it's so much more. Yeah. There's that magic. And although Walt's been gone for a long time, you still sense, you know, sort of the presence of the Walt soul in that park. The way they maintained it. A lot of people get upset about, you know, corporate and the way corporate mm-hmm. takes care of it. You know, it's expensive, you know, but there's a price, I guess, to be paid to maintain yeah. that sort of mm-hmm. level of, you know, and a perfection.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
And you get to be a part of that magic. How cool is that?
It's mm-hmm. neat to be, yeah.
Oh.
Well, just a little bit. Just mm-hmm. a little bit, yeah.
I would say that. Probably on your yeah. gratitude list. You it get is. To be a part of the Disney Magic
yeah.
family.
Yeah. yeah.
Whoa.
That's on my gratitude list. Yeah.
Give me another gratitude.
And the parks, too.
You know, I'm grateful for like my golf club with my buddies. Now that sounds kind of like a shishy thing, but this is not an expensive golf club. Actually, it's a really, really good deal. I almost don't want to say the name of it.
Okay.
So you don't want to keep. You want to stay on.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. No, it's a.
We'll bleep it. Beep. Go ahead.
Just an amazing club. You know, it's in Ventura County. It's on like a hill. You see the ocean. It's quite beautiful. Affordable. I never joined a golf club. You know, I had four kids to put through college. I'm
right.
Like, golf clubs are for rich people, but mm-hmm. there are those that are actually very, very affordable. You know, and this one is 20-minute drive. All my buddies there. I got some of my actor buddies there. Jason Sheff, who's the lead singer of Chicago, is a buddy of mine. He's wow. there. Kevin Dillon's in the joint, you know, with us. And then my buddy Johnny and Paulie and Benny. And we all just go out and we play golf like every day because, you know, we're 60 years old. And
Johnny, Polly, and Benny, first yeah. of all, that's yeah. like a movie yeah. cast right there. Yeah, like, yeah. I want to see that movie.
Yeah, these are my boys, you know. Yeah, we play golf. And it's so beautiful out there in Ventura, and it's cool, you know. You know, one of my buddies is a member at Sherwood. Now, that's a she club.
Oh, is it?
Expensive. But he plays golf more at our joint. It's adequate.
Mm-hmm. Comes down with a riffraff.
Yes. Well, one, you know, if it's 100 degrees at Sherwood, because it doesn't breathe there, it's uh-huh. 80 degrees at, you know.
Beautiful and breezy.
Yes. And it's a great course. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful for these things that I could get to, you know, sort of, you know, just kind of enjoy and chill in mm-hmm. sort of a retired-ish sort of sense. Even though I'm not retired, it's like, all right, I'm not going to do... I'd gone through my IMDb through COVID and strikes and all that. And I guess was in some... You're sort of running a race your whole life when you're an actor and you have to support a family of six. You take any and every stupid job that comes your way. And so I go through my IMDb and I'd be like, well, that was cool. That was cool. That was garbage. That was garbage. That was cool. That was garbage. That was garbage. I'm like, I've taken everything. I'm like, I don't have to. I'm just not right. going to now. And I'm just going to do what I want to do, which was, you know, dive into stand up, you know,
so
do
cool.
that. And that turned into something I could have never imagined. And then, you know, and have some fun gigs coming up, but, try to take as much time off as I can to, you know, family and stuff.
I went through your IMDb and I had never seen an IMDb page where you scroll down and then you can like click to see more, like the amount of projects that you've done didn't even fit on the page. And you had to like click to like see the rest. It was like 219 out of 300 and blah blah blah, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm not gonna read all these. That is a wild. Listen,
it's not all great.
I have like 4 or 5 voiceover gigs under my belt, so same.
You got a lot coming your
way. Thank you. I received that.
Thank you so much.
Say more nice things. I'll receive yes. them all. Yeah. No, I appreciate that. Thank you. I mean, I'm grateful for the gigs that I've had. If you go through my IMDb page, it's like you can take one screenshot on your phone and they all fit on the screenshot. Right. But
you're wonderful and you're funny. People love you and you're doing great. And, you know, and also you're focused on really like the important things too, you know, in life.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know,
I've always been a family girl. And I mean, acting has been my dream. And then stand up is what took off for me. And so I'm on like year 19 now with stand up. And I moved to LA in 2003, and I thought I was going to be a dramatic actress. I didn't realize I was funny.
Yeah.
I mean, my whole family's funny, but I didn't know that I was like funny outside of my family. So I had no idea comedy was a part of my future. I really thought I was going to be a dramatic actress. And then stand-up took off for me. But I still was always looking over my shoulder at Hollywood being like, are you ready for me yet? Are you ready for me to have my show yet? And they're like, no, girl, not yet. And then so I just stay on the road. And then here I am 19 years in and enjoying this stand-up ride. And I don't really look over my shoulder that often anymore to be like, are you ready for me yet? I'm like, just call me when you're ready. I'll be on the road. So that's kind of where I'm at.
The best thing about stand-up is that it is you in this industry with everybody running this industry taking control and doing your own thing, not waiting for the phone to ring, not, you know, and that's why I encourage, you know, everybody, including, you know, my two boys in the biz, you know, I go, to stand-up. I go, you take control. You're not waiting for the phone to ring. You get busy and you do your thing.
Are they trying material. Stand-up?
They're really funny, and I think that they're, you know, they might be testing those waters soon. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. My one son Talon really should. Oh, he's 6'4". He's built like he's an amazing presence, but he's got a great voice too. He does a mean impression of his father. Yes. But you know, he's creating his own path and VO, and both he and Gabriel are doing a lot of interesting stuff, you know. Some Marvel stuff, but they're doing anime and stuff like that, and they're both really, really smart and creative, and it's really fun for me to see them blazing their own paths. Mm-hmm. You know,
very cool.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Do you have any other gratitudes that you would like to throw in the pot before we wrap it up?
My biggest ones are, you know, family and friends.
And who's your best friend?
Oh, I can't narrow that down. Listen, my wife, Kathy, she is my best friend.
Trick question.
Yes. Right answer?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
In regards to my buddies, you know, they all kind of fill different niches, but they're all special in many ways because I have so many buddies that I've known forever.
Love that. That's great.
And they're, you know, they're different, you know. Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm grateful for that. Yeah, true friendships, you know, ones where you know that they do anything for you, you know. Hide a body, and I have an example.
I can draw you a map.
Yeah. But I am thankful for that, yeah. And I'm thankful that, too, you know, there are great parents out there. But, you know, I mean, I had, you know, I had buddies growing up. We were just dirtbags. I mean, the trouble we got into and the lack of respect in certain areas. Mm-hmm. I was very, very, very rebellious, you know. I mean, you know what I was dealing with there. My father was an emergency room doctor who forbade me to ever touch a motorcycle. While I lived at their house and was still a juvenile, not yet 18 years old, bought a motorcycle, kept it parked on the street around the block. Neighbors knew I had it. My parents didn't. They didn't have the heart to tell them. I did drugs. I did stuff, you know, I drove cars when I shouldn't have been. I was, you know, a rebellious mess because too, and a lot of that came up with my father's a wonderful man. He, you know, he did Doctors Without Borders stuff, you know, he's a good man. That being said, also when I was a real little kid, you know, got beat with a belt. Now a belt is a whip because it's leather and it's a whip and it leaves a mark. You don't do that to a child. It builds resentment. So when I got bigger and it was like, you know, F you, I became rebellious. We've always had with all of our kids really, really solid communication. And we never beat our children. And for that reason, I feel grateful. They never held resentments. I'm really glad that I didn't do it to Talon. He's 6'4" and was actually a bodybuilder. But he gives me the best hugs in the world. And I'll give my dad the best hugs in the world. But there was an issue with that. And, you know, and the way we were brought up. You can say, well, it's old school. This is how we were brought up. But I don't care if every father down the street is beating their kids with the belt. Yeah. I'm still not going to feel inclined to ever do so.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful for the fact that our four kids, although I feel like, you know, his parents had something to do with the fact that they were surrounded by great friends, too. Like, all their friends, just first class, awesome guys. And they're just... And you can be a great parent and still your kids can go, you know, go off the rails and, you know, get involved with the wrong people. And next thing you know, they're doing this. But, you know, they, you know, never doing, you know, drugs or horrible shit like cocaine, you know, and stuff that I was doing back then.
Yeah.
You know, from early on. Yeah.
When did your parents find out they had a motorcycle? Or is this the episode? Did they just... I'm so sorry you found out this way.
My dear pop, he passed away about a little over seven years ago. But he found out, before then, We actually had a laugh about it. There were certain issues where it just, you know, at a certain point when they find out, it's like, what, you know, it's too late to get mad.
Sure.
It's like, that happened. Okay, it happened. Yeah.
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 Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know... Angela, the one thing I've asked of my kids, it's the same thing that my father asked of us, is don't ruin your life. I go, we'll give you everything. Don't ruin your life with drugs. Don't ride motorcycles on the streets of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And they've all four have respected that from the very beginning.
That's great.
You know, and then again, I knew that they weren't coming from a rebellious place. And I felt like they would respect that, me not forbidding something and then having them be rebellious. But I am thankful that they did that because I did not.
Yeah.
You know? And I do not from my own experiences on bikes and stuff, you know, how much trouble you can get into. It was dangerous enough to ride motorcycles in the streets of Los Angeles back in the day. Mm-hmm. But now with everybody looking at their cell phones, you know, you just, I don't know how anybody relaxes on a motorcycle because you have to at every second be aware of everybody in their car who is not paying attention.
My dad's been in so many motorcycle accidents.
He's lucky that he has all of his limbs and he's not paralyzed. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. His most recent one was the worst one, for sure. Yeah. And I got a FaceTime call from him while he was laying on the side of the road.
Oh.
And the ambulance and fire truck and stuff was there. Did I ever tell you that story? Mm-mm. No, I got a FaceTime call from my dad. I'm sitting on my couch in Nashville, and I get a FaceTime from my dad, and he still has his helmet on, and he's laying down. And I'm like, what is going on? And all he's telling me is like, it's bad this time. It's real bad this time. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, and I'm like freaking out in this moment. I'm like, what do I do? Like, the emergency is already there. So at this point, I'm just listening to the emergency people talk to my dad and like tell him things. And they're trying to like move him and he's like screaming in pain. I'm like, oh my God. So then I have my husband's phone calling my sister, trying to get a hold of, because she lives in San Jose where my dad lives. So I'm like, what street are you on? Where are you? So then I'm calling family to like try to go and meet him. He was on the side of the freeway.
Right.
He was hit by a 14-year-old driving his grandparents' car with all his friends in the car. Mm-hmm. And he was in like the like fast lane over here. And he hit my dad as he was like trying to cut over, and my dad slid across the rest of the three lanes. He could have easily been run over by the other cars coming on the freeway. Just a wild experience. That he's even alive is wild. And it was a hit and run, and thankfully they ended up, you know.
Well, that comes under the most horrific FaceTime I've ever had in my life. I'm just FaceTiming you to tell you, my beloved daughter, that I'm leaving this place.
Exactly. Yes. He thought he was on his way out. And we had a conversation with my dad recently asking him who his favorite child was. And we all had a vote. And we all said it was my sister, Veronica. And he was like, no, well, I called you first when I got in my accident. And I was like, that is not true. You called Veronica. She didn't answer. And then you called me.
Burn.
That is the truth.
Burn.
Yeah. But thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. Podcast. I do have to tell you that all four of our kids think that they're the favorite. Each one of them will come up to us separately and they'll go, listen, I do know I'm the favorite. And they all believe that they're the favorite. And,
well, that's good that you make them feel that they're the favorite. But do you have one?
No, you not a favorite, but there are the you know, the ones that you get along with, the easiest.
The easiest.
Yes, mm-hmm. And then there's something else with one of the other ones is fascinating, fun, you know, but mm-hmm. there are some that just, you know, kind of, you know, get you a little uh-huh. bit more. It's a little less tenuous. It may be a little bit easier, but mm-hmm. We love them all equally. They're all awesome in their own way. You're awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming out. I appreciate you. Good luck with your stand-up. You don't even need luck. Just have so much fun with your stand-up.
Well, thanks, Angela. But at this point, this year into it, because there's a lot of omits, and then you cut stuff, you add stuff, this and that. But I'm just kind of, you know, get to the point where, do you find this? Where you sometimes you're just like, oh, I'm sick of my stuff now.
Are you kidding me? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm going to film my hour topic next year. February 28th in Los Angeles at the El Rey Theater.
Cool. What a great joint to do that. Yes.
I'm very excited about it.
Please let me know.
Please come. I mean, I would love to have you. So I'm filming that, my hour that I'm currently touring with. And it takes me about 3 years to write a new hour, perfect it, and get it to a place where I'm happy with it. And then perform it across the country and film it at the end, you know? And so I got to like the end of year 1.5 to 2 years. And I'm like, well, this is my hour. I'm done. It needs tweaks and stuff, but this is the hour. And I got to a place where I was like, ew, I don't even like it. Like, is this even funny? And I was getting great response, but I wasn't feeling it inside. I'm like, I don't have that feeling on stage where I'm like, oh, I can't wait to say this joke. Oh, I can't wait to say this joke. Right. I wasn't feeling that feeling. And then I had a friend come out on the road, a comedian named Joe Larson. And I was like, come and watch my set. Come and like see if you can like help me like tweak it, or, you know, just give me some thoughts and notes. And he helped me like, maybe if you move this over here, maybe if you try it like this. And we did like some slight adjustments. It wasn't even like full on surgery, taking out organs. It was just like a little cosmetic surgery, like just adjust this and this and this. And all of a sudden, like, that was the sauce it needed. Yeah. And now I'm on stage. I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait to do this part. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, yes, I do get that way with my hour. And then at that point, I call in reinforcements. I'm like, hey, come watch this.
Yeah.
Come tell me, what do you see? Yeah. What am I not getting? What's not this part right here? It doesn't click. Help me. What is it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Awesome.
I can't wait to see your hour.
Yeah. Cool.
When does it come out? You filmed your special.
We're in editing right now, you know, so then we'll see where, you know, and then we're just going to try to, you know, market it, you know, and we'll see, you know, we'll go to, you know, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon. And if nobody buys, it's just an expensive YouTube video.
Yeah, I get it. I released mine on YouTube. And let me tell you, it was expensive. Yeah. My first one. I've done two on YouTube now. I've had a Netflix special. Comedy Central was my first one.
Yeah.
And the last two were YouTube, and one of them I did in a very reasonable budget where I'm like, this makes sense.
This ours was too, you know, I just decided, I go, look, I'm the one who wrote this. I'm the one who's done all the work here. I'm going to produce this. I want to do this the way I want to do it. And so we did it at the El Portal Theater there in North Hollywood. And we shot two shows in a night, and, cause I wanted to have some creative control over it, but it's been an exhausting year, but you know, the light at the end of the tunnel for me, and like you said, is, oh wow, next year I don't have to, you know, just, you know, pop up 15 minutes here and there, work, you know, when you decide you got another hour and you want to go out, you go out. But other than that, I don't have any commitments there. All right. Well, I can't wait to see yours.
Thank you. I can't.
Yeah. So let me know.
Thank you. We'll watch each other's and report back.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.